Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as a company, Microsoft is dismayed by the forcible separation of children from their families at the border, the global tech company declared in a statement. Family unification has been a fundamental tenet of American policy and law since the end of World War II. The same Microsoft bragged a few months ago about ICE's use of its Azure cloud computing services to accelerate facial recognition and identification of immigrants, though the post has since been altered to omit the phrase, "We're proud to support this work with our mission-critical cloud." The spotlight on the White House's inhumane agenda on immigration and immigrants is exposing more than the devastatingly cruel practices in force at the border, but also the numerous big corporate and institutional players that are, often invisibly, enabling that agenda. And just like the agenda, the impact of these collaborations extends well beyond immigrant communities. We'll talk about all of that with organizer advocate Tracy Rosenberg, executive director of Media Alliance and co-coordinator of Oakland Privacy. Also on the show, the 2018 Farm Bill has been in the news mainly because of House Republicans' vehement efforts to deny more people the roughly $1.40 per meal subsidy provided by the SNAP program, whose participants are overwhelmingly children, the elderly, and people with disabilities. Whether such punitive, evidence-free ideas make it through to the final legislation will certainly be a test of something. The undercovered farm bill affects a number of other things as well. Crop subsidies, conservation, and big picture, our ability to move toward a food system that's thriving, sustainable, and healthy. We'll hear about that from Patty Lavera, Assistant Director at Food and Water Watch. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Employees of the Department of Homeland Security received tips from leadership about how to protect themselves while in public, saying they may face a heightened threat as more and more people protest the cruel and malicious treatment of immigrants and asylum seekers at the Mexican border. From DHS head Kirsten Nielsen being heckled out of a restaurant, to protesters in Portland blockading the entrance to the ICE office there, a tactic spreading now to other cities, to the city of Sacramento saying they would no longer be used as a warehouse for ICE detainees. Acts of defiance are growing. But as some are trying to disassociate from the enforcers of the White House's inhumane and racist agenda, some big-name companies are moving in the opposite direction, quietly contracting with federal agencies for millions of dollars, in some cases enabling some of the most distressing programs and tactics. And that's just the ones we know about. Our next guest works to bring some daylight to these shadowy things. Organizer and advocate Tracy Rosenberg is executive director of Media Alliance and co-coordinator of the group Oakland Privacy. She joins us now by phone from Oakland. Welcome to Counterspin, Tracy Rosenberg.
Much thanks and glad to be here.
Well, it was heartening to me that people were not lulled by Trump's rescinding of the order on family separation. They see that the wrongs here are deeper and bigger, and that this policy is hydra-headed, as it were. But as some of what ICE does is exposed, much is still shadowy by design, including collaborations with big tech and even media companies that are trying to show a very different public face. I wanted to ask you first about something that you wrote about last fall that I know is going to surprise many listeners, a relationship between ICE and Reuters.
Yeah, I'm glad that you use the word hydra-headed, Janine, because in the surveillance and privacy work that I've been doing for the past couple of years, it is in fact hydra-headed. And you find things out all of the time. And one of the things that I happened to stumble across about 9 or 10 months ago was a history of large contracts between the parent company of Reuters Journalism, which is, of course, one of the biggest press agencies in the world, and ICE, that consisted largely of providing information services from sort of the parent company to Immigrations and Customs Enforcement in the form of a database called CLEAR.
And what is that? What does CLEAR do?
CLEAR is one of the largest consumer information databases. Basically, it correlates all kinds of personal information about people, addresses, credit records, employment records, real estate records, and puts them together in a package. And essentially, this vast database of personal information is now available to ICE. It includes telephone records, license plate, really a comprehensive portrait of a person's life.
And indeed, the contract, you know, makes it clear that they don't hedge it. They say we're trying to locate, arrest, and remove criminal aliens that pose a threat to public safety. I mean, that, as I understand, is right there in the contract that, in this case, Thomson Reuters has signed up for.
That's correct. The contract specifically is with enforcement and removal operations, which is Trump's deportation army. And its purpose is to help them identify, find, and locate people. So the question here is, as a journalist who works for an agency like Reuters and reports on immigration policy, there's a certain sort of basic compromise that occurs here, yeah, both in terms of what you can say and whether your right hand and your left hand, as it were, are operating in the same direction. The piece was called Sanctuary Journalism because we thought that for media outlets that are really serving communities that are sanctuary jurisdictions, mm-hmm, there's an issue here, and it's not small.
Right. And there's a basic conflict that I think more and more people are seeing, including employees within some of these entities. Amazon, for example, whose facial recognition software is heavily marketed to law enforcement and government. Those workers have just sent some of them a letter saying bluntly, quote, "We refuse to build the platform that powers ICE, and we refuse to contribute to tools that violate human rights," close quote. So there's,
yes,
pushback happening, it seems like, because it's clear from the Amazon example, which is about ICE, but this use of data to ensnare people is not just about immigrants, of course.
Right. What I wanted to say is that basically this is broad. Google employees have done the same things. We're now finding a number of nonprofits that work in childcare services that have signed contracts with ICE to run these separated minor camps like Southwest Key, which was funded by a number of progressive foundations and has been literally operating detention camps for children who have been forcibly separated from their families. So what we have, as you said, is this sort of hydra-headed web in which so many of us are finding that we have been complicit.
Well, when we say it's broader than immigration and it's about use of surveillance by a number of law enforcement agencies, I know that it's a national problem, but you work very locally as well. And I just wonder if you could tell us some of the thing that you found out. I think it's a fascinating story about the license plate readers.
Well, we argue for local action. And the reason for that is when all of the Snowden revelations came out years ago, I, like many other people, and in my own work as a telecom advocate, I really saw online surveillance and spying as a huge problem. That's sort of how I got into this venue. It's like, well, what are we going to do? Is occupy the NSA a realistic strategy? And the answer there is no. So the question became, what can we really do in our own homes and our own communities? So we started to investigate the links, like where is the information traveling? How is it being collected? Where is it being stored and who has access to it? And once you open that Pandora's box, a lot of stuff comes falling out. On license plate readers, these are sort of ubiquitous. In the past decade, they really have been set up in probably the majority of cities and counties in the U.S. And they take a photograph of the front of a car. They're usually pole-mounted on traffic lights as it goes by. And essentially, if you are one of those people who happens to drive back and forth every single day past one of these, it can geolocate you in time and space. based on your license plate, on a fairly regular basis for people who live in cities that are inundated with these things, and the data is kept for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, it really can provide a pattern of your daily activities. And that can include things like parking lots of mosques or cannabis clinics or buildings with immigration lawyer offices or political meetings of various kinds, Black Lives Matter meetings. There are all kinds of ways in which geolocating people can give you all kinds of information about what they are doing. And when we're talking about actions of dissidents or political activities or immigration status, these can become ways to hunt, track, and profile and capture people. When it comes to sort of license plate readers, the ubiquity of them really opened up the question of who has access to this data, where is it stored, is it secure, and what are the limitations in terms of how it's used? And the answer to that, unfortunately, as you sort of dug in, became, well, there's not really a policy, and if there is one, it sort of says we can use it for any legitimate law enforcement purpose, and really any agency can ask us for the data, and we'll send it to them. Because, you know, that would only be the civil thing with any other law enforcement agency. And basically, there were no rules. Work that we did basically involved, well, let's pluck this stuff out. Let's find out, you know, how many license plates, where are they, who are they shared with? And secondly, let's start talking about what the policy is or what it should be. Because obviously, the machines are there. We can't take them off the traffic poles. Well, we can, and we hope to, but that's a long-term process.
Right.
But in the short term, what can we do to define what's the appropriate use of all this data, and there's a lot of it, and what are the inappropriate uses, and how are we going to have a public conversation about that?
And that starts with knowing that it's happening, you know, and that's where I think I'd like to ask you about the Aaron Swartz Day Police Surveillance Project. One of the things that we most remember about Aaron Swartz, a kind of information activist who kind of wanted to liberate information against powerful forces that were making money off it, in this case about scholarly publishing and JSTOR. Mm-hmm. But really part of the message was, if I can be crude, it's like nerds can be activists too. You know, that there are lots of different ways to use information, you know, that learning how your local government, how your local council works, how to move things off the consent calendar, these kinds of things can really be a way to change things, as they have been in Oakland, for example.
Yes. Aaron Swartz's whole gig was free the information and the power will come. And I think that is largely something that we've learned and put into practice. And what we've also found is when you talk to city council members, the people who vote on things and authorize things, I don't want to say 9 times out of 10, but like pretty darn frequently, they really have no idea how this all works. And a lot of our work has been telling them, we've done the research. This is what's going on in your city. Did you agree to this? And do you want this to continue as it is? Or do you want to step up here and do some legislating and do some policy work and pay attention? Because most of this has gone on largely underground. The cops do what the cops want to do. Just like Microsoft employees and Amazon employees didn't know, most of them from the ground, what their companies were doing. And when they found out, they were appalled. In terms of the Aaron Swartz Project, what we're largely trying to do is just sort of crowdsource this enormous project of getting down to the local details in every city and county. And we're starting in California, and we hope to spread it across the whole country, which is go and find this stuff out. We have FOIA. We have a Public Records Act in most states.
Right.
We can get this information. And once we get this information, we have the ability to change the local conditions on the ground. And in Oakland, we have done that. We have a comprehensive surveillance ordinance in place. Nothing happens now without authorization, and we are going to get regular, steady, constant reports, and we essentially have policy control based in the community. Because the thing about mass bulk surveillance is it's collected on everybody, and it's basically being sort of held there on the off chance that it might help with some criminal occurrence What we found, for example, in California, in Los Angeles, there was a lawsuit to get license plate reader data from the LAPD. And what the LAPD said in court, and this went all the way to the California Supreme Court, was we don't have to release that data to you because it's evidence in a criminal proceeding. And we said a criminal proceeding on every single person who has driven through the city of Los Angeles for the past 5 years. And they said, well, you know, it might be in some future case. And essentially what that means is a premise that data collection goes on in order to convict us of a crime that has not yet happened, that we haven't committed. And we need to turn that whole structure on its head, which is to say that data needs to serve a public safety purpose, or there's no reason to collect it. We can't preemptively create a police state based on future crime. Can't do it. That's George Orwell.
Finally, NBC News recently did a piece picking up on some of what you wrote about last fall about these corporate collaborations. And they mentioned Palantir, this company run by Facebook board member Peter Thiel, that runs this intelligence database that tracks immigrants' records and relationships called Falcon. Mm-hmm. And NBC described Palantir as a data firm that tends to stay out of the press. You know, and then Facebook, no comment. Motorola, no comment. Power doesn't want this information out there. So if we want to know about it, that's just another argument for the importance of independent media, isn't it?
Yes. My argument has always been, because, you know, it's fair to say, well, what does transparency really do? All it does is tell us the various ways in which we are being oppressed and tracked and hunted and profiled, but it doesn't stop it. But the reality is that there's such a battle being fought against transparency, and it's so unwanted, both by law enforcement and tech and private vendors and the whole military industrial complex that we have to deal with, because there is tremendous power in transparency. Once it becomes clear the scope of things, then a meaningful response of community control is possible. We can't do it without transparency, so we have to start there and fight for that to become the principle. And then the boundaries, the constraints, and the limitations become a political battle that we can fight and we can win.
We've been speaking with Tracy Rosenberg. She's Executive Director of Media Alliance and co-coordinator of the group Oakland Privacy. Tracy Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
After House Republicans passed their farm bill, reportedly the first time the critical measure involving everything from nutrition assistance to crop subsidies has passed either chamber with only single-party support, Donald Trump tweeted, "Farm bill just passed in the House. So happy to see work requirements included. Big win for the farmers." Among other things, Trump doesn't mean farmers like the Callahan family, profiled in Civil Eats, small farmers in South Carolina who not only qualify for SNAP, the food assistance program Trump is crowing over, making harder to access, but who benefit also from programs Republicans would cut that encourage the farmers markets, where the family make much of their income, including selling to people who pay with SNAP benefits. The Senate version pushes back on some of that, but does that make it good? And what else should we know about what's likely to be in the final legislation due by the end of September? Patty Lavera is the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. She coordinates the food team. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Patty Lavera.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, there's so many elements to this $860 billion legislation. It's easy to miss things. We've seen some attention, and rightly so, on what was apparently the House Democrats' sticking point, the restrictions that Republicans want to add to SNAP. I want to get to other things, too, but what is your sense of whether this very familiar, punitive, non-evidence-based stuff to do with food assistance programs, is that going to make it through conference, do you think?
That is the question. You know, every 5 years or so, give or take a year, we do a farm bill. And in the last several cycles, this has been the really big question. And last time, which was the 2012 farm bill, which didn't actually get finished till 2014, a lot of the sticking point was this question. And it's become this ideological battle over the role of the government in, you know, providing some kind of safety net. And really the biggest safety net for most families that is left, you know, after welfare reform in the 90s and lots of other changes, the most common safety net at this point for lots of folks is SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which provides some assistance, you know, cash assistance for people to buy food. The marriage between providing some assistance to people through food stamps or SNAP was supposed to keep urban and suburban members of the House interested in this bill, even if they didn't need farm programs.
Right.
What we're going to see in the Senate is the margin is so close they can't pass a bill with just one party like they did in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the hope for kind of dialing back this aggressive attack on SNAP really comes from the Senate.
Well, with the focus on that, and as I say, it's deserved to, you know, explode the rationales behind this punitive stuff. But there's other stuff, a whole lot of other stuff in the Farm Bill. And I just wonder if you could tell us about some of the other points of concern that maybe are being less openly discussed.
Sure. You're right. This fight over the safety net program of SNAP has really dominated the discussion, you know, justifiably, and it's also the biggest expenditure under this bill by a huge margin. It's like 75% to 80% of the spending. But lots and lots and lots of things that impact the way our food system operates come from the Farm Bill. I think if you're not involved in farming, people don't realize the extent to which the government is involved in this industry, in this marketplace, whether it's something you would call a subsidy to a farmer who's growing corn or soybeans, or it's crop insurance, the government is involved in those programs. Research into the environmental impacts of different farming practices, support to get farmers to do different environmental practices, you know, to improve water quality or adapt to climate change. Like, there's a lot of moving parts of this thing. If the bill doesn't happen on time by September 30th, some of those programs, especially, you know, a lot of people call them kind of like the tiny but mighty programs that help people transition to organic agriculture or help young farmers get started or help people use food stamps at a farmer's market. Like, a lot of those programs are written that they expire if the farm bill expires. So there is damage that's done if this process breaks down.
We see sort of the country moving in one direction. Folks who are able to are looking to eat healthier, who are looking to eat in a sustainable way, you know, who are looking to eat more locally. All these things are happening, and yet consumer power doesn't play out the way you might think it will when the crops that have the biggest environmental impact don't really, you know, it's not the green beans that you're getting at the market from upstate.
Yeah, I mean, our food system looks the way it looks for a lot of reasons, and a lot of those reasons are policy.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us voted to have this unhealthy, environmentally damaging system. And if you listen to kind of the ideology around, well, if you don't like the food system, it's because that's what you're voting for with your dollars, it's more complicated than that. Farmers grow what they can sell. And in Nebraska, there's not enough people to buy direct from them if they just switch to green beans, right? So we have commodity markets. We have very elaborate systems that big corporations have designed, and they have designed our farm policy to support them. And actually, in those markets for these commodity crops, corn and soybeans and dairy, farmers are having yet another terrible year. We're going 4 and 5 years into terrible farm prices. And when you add to that all of this confusion being caused by the Trump administration's daily changes of trade policy, there's a lot of chaos and there's a lot of fear. And what we're getting from Congress is kind of the same old thing. The House is just waging welfare reform disguised as a farm bill, and the Senate's kind of doing the same old thing. And it really isn't fixing a lot of the problems we have, which is a really corporate-controlled system that drives people to overproduce these crops.
Well, and that's just what I wanted to get to, because I think in a lot of areas of life right now, folks are trying to have really an alternate vision, you know, to not just rail against what is, but to put forward, you know, we could do things differently. And the food system, of course, is a hugely important piece of that, or could be. And if we want to have a system that serves, you know, the most people, the healthiest food, and allows people who grow that food to have a life, how fundamental a shift would that require? Is that something that you can do through politics?
We can. It's a good question. We can. We just haven't done it for a lot of years. And at the core of it, again, it's ideological, kind of in the New Deal era into the 70s and 80s, we had a lot of policies that dealt with the fact that farmers act on their own. Your individual inclination as a farmer is to produce as much as you can, right? And even if you don't make a lot for every bushel of corn, maybe you'll make it up by selling more bushels. When you add that up together across all those farmers, that's a disaster economically because you have so much corn, the price goes down. So we used to have a lot of policies that when you knitted them together, there was multiple moving parts. We used to have a price floor, which was like a minimum wage to say the price of corn will just not go below X. We used to pay farmers to not farm some acres, say, you know, it's near water, you're going to lose all your soil, don't farm there, we'll pay you a little rent not to. We used to have a reserve. If there was too much corn, we'd get it off the market to help the price for farmers a little bit. All of those things together dealt with kind of this natural inclination to just overproduce, which is the natural human inclination. Mm-hmm. We've chipped away at those over the years through things like farm bills. We don't have them, and now we have too much of a lot of these things. We have bad prices for farmers, and so, oh, now we do a little thing where they can maybe get crop insurance to maybe make up for some of that, but instead what we do is we look for other places to dump these foods, and maybe it's corn syrup in everything. Right. Maybe it's that we put cheese in the crust of the pizza because we have so much milk, we got to find more places to put the cheese. And we also do it through our trade policy. So all of these fights about yelling at Canada because they have a system that protects their dairy farmers, rather than ruin the economics of Canadian dairy farmers, maybe we could talk about why we have so much milk here, we have to find places to dump it.
Well, we'll end on that note. There's clearly much more to be discussed here, and we'll follow this bill as it makes its way through conference by, it's really got to be the end of September, right?
Mitch McConnell says he wants to do it by July 4th. The current bill expires at the end of September. They can extend it. They've done it before to keep these programs running, but they do wave that deadline around. So we'll see what happens as we get into the heat of the summer.
We've been speaking with Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch. They're online at foodandwaterwatch.org. Thanks so much, Patty Lavera, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.